You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Jada Lucas.
And I'm Leanne Moroz. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, January 29th, 2018.
No fornication on screen, no homosexual anything on screen. You couldn't display drug use. You couldn't display miscegenation. You had to have, you know, twin beds even for married couples.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Michael Glab speaks with IU Associate Professor Joan Hawkins about the politics of taste. That's coming up on today's edition of Big Talk with Michael Glab.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Activate's Lucy Shake speaks with Bloomington Symphony Orchestra's Donna Laferty. That's coming up on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, your daily local headlines.
A coalition of health and business agencies are pushing to raise the taxes on cigarette sales by $1.50. The coalition, called Tobacco Free Indiana, represents the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Indiana, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, the Indiana Hospital Association, the Indiana Rural Health Association, the Indiana State Medical Association, and the Indy Chamber of Commerce. Chair of Tobacco Free Indiana, Brian Hannon, says raising the tax on cigarettes will translate to increases in public health across the state.
You know, we do have one of the lowest cigarette tax rates in the country, certainly lower than most of our neighboring states. And we know there's a direct correlation. Anytime you raise the cigarette tax by a significant amount, you see use rates start to go down. And so you'll see smokers who start to quit. You'll see smokers who start to cut back. And most importantly, you'll see kids that get priced out and they never pick up the product in the first place. And so we know it works. It's the most effective thing we can do to reduce smoking rates is to raise the price via a cigarette tax increase. And that's why we're advocating for it, is we have one of the lower tax rates in the country and we have one of the higher smoking rates in the country. And so it's a problem that requires action. You know, policymakers really need to get on board and help us do something about tackling these high tobacco use rates. And we know that raising the cigarette tax rate is the best thing we can do to achieve that result.
Hannon says the only provision of Tobacco-Free Indiana's House bill to move out of committee today would raise the legal cigarette smoking age to 21 years old.
And so that's the provision that will move forward. We anticipate it will be discussed and debated on the House floor, and we're hopeful that we can move it out of the House this year and move it over to the Senate for consideration over there. To your question about who's pushing the bill and authoring the bill, Representative Charlie Brown from Gary is the author of the bill, and he picked up some co-authors on the bill today as well. So this is an issue that, you know, enjoyed strong support in the Public Health Committee, strong bipartisan support, people on both sides of the aisle and both from both parties understand the importance of doing something about tobacco. And we think Tobacco 21 is a good first step.
Hannon says before it was stripped from the bill, Tobacco Free Indiana planned to lobby for the $1.50 increase in cigarette taxes to go to expanding public health projects throughout the state.
What we have always advocated for is that of the more than $300 million a $1.50 cigarette tax would raise, we would certainly want to see most of that, if not all of that, reinvested in public health programs. Indiana ranks very low when it comes to our investment in public health programs. And so, you know, as public health advocates, we really want to see some more investment in our programs that will help improve health, help people, Hoosiers access care, and improve their quality of life and their outcomes. And so, although we haven't detailed out specific programs that we say this ought to go to, generally speaking, we want to see this move toward some of Indiana's public health programming.
House Bill 1380 was passed unanimously in the House committee this morning. So far, 5 states have passed bills to raise the minimum age to purchase tobacco to 21 years old.
A study published today says Indiana's decision to repeal the state's prevailing wage law has negatively impacted construction wages, job growth, and productivity. The Midwest Economic Policy Institute report also states that the decision to repeal what is termed the common construction wage in the state also failed to produce taxpayer savings. Frank Manzo IV authored the study. He's also the director of the Midwest Economic Policy Institute. Manzo says the study, which looked at the building of public schools in northern Indiana, found that, despite legislative promises, repealing the common construction wage has failed to reduce taxpayer savings.
What we find is that repeal of common construction wage lowers wages of blue-collar construction workers, and in particular, reduce the wages of the lowest paid construction workers. And this is because common construction wage is essentially a minimum wage for skilled construction labor. And by repealing that minimum wage for skilled construction labor, the lowest paid construction workers, the poorest, the lowest skilled, actually were most negatively impacted. And in addition, what we have found is that repeal increased worker turnover, and that has a negative impact on construction businesses, and reduced productivity of the average construction worker. So by reducing productivity, increasing turnover, and lowering the skill levels of construction workers, we find that that has offset the impact of lower labor costs on public construction projects and has offset any reported decrease in taxpayer costs. Basically, the effect has been that taxpayers haven't saved a penny.
Manzo says when lawmakers were working to weaken provisions in the common construction wage in southern Indiana, weakened legislation led to out-of-state workers taking taxpayer-funded jobs.
So in particular, we saw that in southern Indiana, 800 public works construction workers lost their jobs during the period of weakening common construction wage, and actually the same amount, roughly 800 on average, Kentucky construction workers got new jobs along the border of Indiana, and the implication being that those jobs were shifted to workers in Kentucky, which did have prevailing wage at the time, but were on average lower paying wages. And so by eliminating the common construction wage rates, that the minimum wages that were paid to Indiana construction workers, that actually opened kind of the floodgates to out-of-state contractors to win bids on jobs that are funded by Hoosier taxpayers, and then they, you know, take those earnings back with them when they go back to Kentucky or to other states.
Manzo says, while the study applied primarily to the building of northern Indiana public schools, which he says has a fairly common price and labor requirement, it would be fair to assume that the repeal of the common construction wage has had similar consequences for laborers in southern Indiana, including along the Interstate 69 corridor.
The B Corp, a Bloomington-based tech startup, has won over $200,000 in grants from the National Science Foundation. WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester brings us this report.
Local agriculture tech startup The B Corp has received a $225,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. The startup was founded by Indiana University graduates last year and specializes in technology aimed at helping beekeepers on a hobbyist and industrial scale. The grant is an SBIR Phase 1 grant, which is designed to give startup companies with proposed research and development ideas a 6-month to 1-year stipend. The stipend is then used to help further fund R&D efforts by the company.
You know, the whole process took probably 6 months after we submitted it. We heard back from NSF that we had been selected for the next step, and they just wanted to do some due diligence and, you know, make sure that we had the claims that we had made, we can back up and all that. So there was a few rounds of those, just making sure that we had all of our bases covered and all that, and really around December is when we heard back that it was confirmed and just had to do some final administrative stuff.
That was Wyatt Wells, chief marketing officer and a founding member of the B Corp. B Corp is also pursuing an additional $50,000 grant from Elevate Ventures, a venture development group that helps develop emerging high-potential businesses. The new funding grants will also allow B Corp to help develop new technology specifically targeted at countering pest and disease-related issues.
what we're trying to do is look at a lot more of the factors that are contributing to hive decline. So that could be pests in the hive. It could be the varroa mite is a big one. It could be pesticides that they pick up while they're foraging out in commercial agricultural fields. And it could be a bunch of other things that are going on in the hive. So that's really what we're looking to research.
The company has also hired on its first non-founder member, Gretchen Riggs. Riggs will take over the position of data science for the company. She will also be leading a three-person team of IU grad students to develop algorithms and make design recommendations for the company's upcoming project.
She's going to be really taking on the whole data science project. We'd like her to kind of take ownership of all of the data science stuff that our CEO, Ellie's been kind of running for now.
In addition to hiring the three IU graduate students, the B Corp hopes to use some of its new funding to conduct joint projects with IU's data science department. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Leanne Moroz.
And I'm Jada Lucas. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. Associate Professor at Indiana University's Media School, Joan Hawkins, is helping organize a conference and festival marking the 50th anniversary of a landmark, revolutionary year in global history, titled Wounded Galaxies 1968, Paris, Prague, Chicago. The conference runs from February 6th through the 11th on the IU campus and at various venues throughout Bloomington. A pre-conference festival begins with the showing of the horror film Night of the Living Dead on Thursday, February 8th at the IU Cinema. Joan speaks with WFHB's Michael Glab about the taste politics behind the film for the latest edition of Big Talk.
You've got some interests. Among them...
Boy, do I have interests.
Yeah. Feminist theory, of course.
Yeah.
But horror cinema, yeah. The avant-garde.
Yeah.
And something called taste politics. Yeah. What's taste politics?
Well, taste politics is a recognition of the fact that, you know, we often talk about taste as though it were a universal, an ahistorical universal thing. So we say something's in good taste or it's in bad taste.
Yeah, yeah.
And along with that comes a kind of more pernicious notion that you can recognize what's art, what's good art, and what's low culture, what's not so good art. And taken to its furthest extreme, like what's art, what's pornography, what's art, what's body genre. And taste politics says that actually this thing that purports to be sort of a universal is actually very historically and class inflected.
Uh-huh.
So it's a certain notion of middle class, middle brow values that get established as the normative, and that anything that diverges from that can be seen in bad taste. And we argue about this endlessly. It's why we have had trials for books like Naked Lunch,
yeah,
for poems like Howl, for books like Ulysses, things that now are recognized as great literature and are taught in English language classes, which were, at least in the case of Naked Lunch, was originally published by Grove Press, where Grove Press had made its money publishing pornography.
Hmm.
And so the trial of Naked Lunch was, you know, is this porn or yeah, is it not porn? Sylvia Beach in Paris published Ulysses on her own dime.
Yeah.
And that was... we couldn't import it into the United States. It was seized at the border. Lawrence Ferlinghetti had, you know, City Lights was and it wasn't even Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It was the poor desk clerk at City Lights who sold this FBI agent his copy of Howl. He was
right.
The poor dude who was arrested and, you know, put on trial for this thing. And then Lawrence came in sort of as a backup because he had actually helped to publish it. But and those trials, it always revolves around, like, is this art, meaning is there some higher purpose to just titillating the sentences?
Yeah, or prurient interest.
Right, or is it just prurient?
Yeah.
And one of the things that taste politics says is, you know, those dividing lines aren't always so easily drawn. That I mean, I think, well, I could go on and on because it's this area that I work in, but I think, you know, people, we embrace like European art cinema and we think of it as art cinema. And yet when it first came into the United States, the Hays Code was still operating.
Right.
When European movies started coming here in a major way. Well, according to the mandates of the Hays Code, if you did not have the Hays Code seal of approval, which said no fornication on screen, no homosexual anything on screen, you couldn't display drug use, you couldn't mm-hmm. display miscegenation, you had to have, you know, twin beds even for married couples.
And the bad guy had to come a cropper.
He had to come a cropper. So much so that when they made the original Scarface, which ends with the bad guy being killed, the Hays Code office kicked it back, Will Hays' office kicked it back and said, you still have to add something to show that, so that people won't think that it's still okay. So they not only had to have him killed, they introduced that entire hysterical scene at the end of Scarface where not only is he going to be killed, but he goes into absolute hysterics. He's whining, he's crying, he's shuddering in the corner saying, you know, why did I do this with my life, yada, yada, after being Mr. Tough Guy through the whole film. Anyway, I digress. But but when art cinema first started coming into the United States, and we didn't have, you know, landmark cinemas. We didn't have like the small art house theaters yet. They were going into these bump and grind houses where you didn't need a seal of approval to be shown. So they were being shown down on Times Square. They were not
right.
being shown, you know, uptown. They were being shown way downtown. And so Taste Politics says, you know, we have to examine this thing that we call taste. And we have to be willing to look at how these things are used, how high culture's invested in a lot of things that we would ordinarily consider to be in bad taste, is certainly invested in things that at times have been called prurient, at times have been called pornography, and that low culture is rarely just low culture. One of the films that we're going to be showing, Night of the Living Dead, there's a beautiful sequence in Night of the Living Dead where this young woman, Barbara, who's seen her brother torn apart by zombies, and she's now in this farmhouse, and she's going to become catatonic very soon. And she's already in terrible shock. But Ben tells her to go find some wood so he can board up these windows. And she does that. She goes into the living room and she sees this little, it's like a lantern, a mirror lantern. And she turns it on and there's like this exquisite, exquisite sequence in the middle of this movie that just has these mirrors catching the light and reflecting her face. It serves no narrative purpose in the movie. There's no reason for it to be in this movie. It's just this pure aesthetic moment in this film that was made for $100,000. It couldn't even get into mainstream movies at the beginning. It was just being shown in drive-ins. Yeah.
It was considered schlock.
It was considered schlock. It's one of the greatest movies made in 1968, according to me.
Right.
In my opinion. It's certainly the most, I think it's the most radical film made about race.
Yes.
In the 60s, you know, when you think that Sidney Poitier was our great African-American actor at that time, and he was making these movies as necessary and wonderful as they were, but where he always played this man who with great dignity and forbearance and patience would put up with the Rod Steigers of this world and go through, you know, episode after episode after episode after episode with them where they would be racist and they would be horrible to him, and then would finally, at the end of the movie, they would grudgingly acknowledge that he was, you know, intelligent, and they would finally call him Mr. Tibbs.
Right.
So at the same time that that film is coming out, where your black hero is this man who is a hero because he's like this Zen master, you have Ben in Night of the Living Dead, who is pummeling Harry Cooper throughout the movie as these two men, it's a patriarchal battle, who's going to control the resources of the farmhouse, but it's a black man and a white man.
Yeah.
And it is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And at the end, Ben shoots Harry. And I mean, one of the things that's really amazing about that film is that the very end sequence, Ben should be the surviving hero. And of course, in the logic of 68, he cannot be. And so there is this reversal at the end of the film where white power is once again reinscribed.
That was IU Media School Associate Professor Joan Hawkins speaking with Big Talk's Michael Glab. Tune in every Thursday at 5:30 p.m. for a new full edition of Big Talk.
Support for WFHB also comes from Lauren Wood Builders. Lauren Wood Builders is a family-owned company that sources local materials and local craftsmen to minimize environmental impact and sustain community. More information is available online at laurenwoodbuilders.com.
Now, it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference. Volunteer.
Hi, my name is Donna Lafferty and I volunteer with the Bloomington Symphony Orchestra. I joined the orchestra in 1998, just as a trombone player. They needed a trombonist, and I said sure. Initially, I wasn't that engaged, but I started seeing needs for jobs to be done. So for a while, I volunteered as the personnel manager. I think I did that for like 5 years. Then I signed up to be on the board of directors, and I did that for 3 years. And I led the operations and development committee for a while. Then they needed an executive director, and that was about 5 years ago, and I said sure. So now that's what I do. The thing about the BSO is there are so many people participating in so many different levels and layers and stuff. You know, we have the musicians, we have the board, we have staff, we have other volunteers. There's just so many different things that this orchestra does and is involved in. And it's all such good stuff. And it inspires me every day to just want to keep coming and doing more. When I'm in rehearsal or in a performance with 75 of my best friends in the whole world, and we're working on this incredible music. It's probably something I haven't played before. So we're all learning this, and we're playing together. We're listening. We're breathing together. We're all responding to, you know, cues from each other and from the conductor and stuff. There's nothing like it. It's just, it's so moving to me. And you know, I always, even if I go into rehearsal thinking, oh my God, I'm so tired, and it's been such a rough week and everything, I go in, I come out of rehearsal super excited about what we're doing. So, you know, selfishly, that motivates me. Another thing that motivates me is how I see the responses of people that come to our concerts or get involved in our outreach stuff. We do a few shows in places that are kind of off the beaten path, you know, not mainstream venues. Every single time we do one of those shows, people come running up to the musicians afterwards, start hugging us, asking if they can take selfies, say, oh, you're the first orchestra we've ever seen, and that sort of thing. So that's so exciting. About a little over a year ago, we got approached by a lady named Yvonne, whose husband had recently passed away. And Yvonne said that Richard, her late husband, had loved classical music his whole life. They went to every orchestra concert they could possibly find, and he had very specific pieces of music that were his favorites and everything. And to honor his life, she wanted an orchestra to play his top pieces that he loved. Would we do that? It was a lot of work, but after a year's work, we did this concert. It was cathartic for her, and it helped her process what had happened. And she just sat there with tears of joy running down her face through the whole concert. And now she's a very dear friend of mine because we went through a lot of stuff together. So anyway, Yvonne, if you're listening, I'm sorry for crying about it. Anyway, so yes, we do make a difference, and that was the biggest example I can think of. If you haven't been to one of our concerts, consider coming. It's really everybody's orchestra, and it's not intimidating at all. It's welcoming, warm, fun, and just the best thing in my life. Thanks for listening. My name is Donna Lafferty, and I volunteer with the Bloomington Symphony Orchestra.
You may visit the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network website to see a full organization profile at bloomington.in.gov/volunteer. Now here's a rundown of current volunteer opportunities in Bloomington and Monroe County.
For the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake with three featured volunteer opportunities for the week. Have you thought of joining a nonprofit board of directors? Gain insight into how to be an effective board member at the Bloomington Volunteer Network's Nonprofit Board Certificate Seminar from 1 to 5 p.m. on February 22nd. Interested, new, and veteran board members are all encouraged to attend. Register on the Volunteer Network website. Or get trained to be a community mediator through the Community Justice and Mediation Center, their 40-hour training program for community members interested in learning about conflict resolution, mediation, and restorative justice begins February 10th. There's a fee, but scholarships are available. And finally, you only have until February 2nd to submit your nomination of an inspiring volunteer or volunteer group for a 2018 Be More Award. Do you know someone who deserves to be recognized? 10 volunteers will receive a Be More Award on March 27th. Submit a nomination online today. And that's a look at just some of the ways you can connect to your community through volunteering. For WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin and Jonah Chester in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Activate is produced by Lucy Shake from the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Leanne Morose.
And I'm Jada Lucas. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for KiteLine, a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system. Coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.